Ever since modern Australia was founded as a thinly populated English-speaking outpost in the South Pacific, we've looked to other bigger powers, our great and powerful friends, to guarantee our security. First it was Britain, then as the Brits retreated from this part of the world, the United States filled the vacuum. America's willingness in the post-war years to underwrite the security of Japan and South Korea, the Philippines, and to a lesser extent Australia too, has allowed all these countries to spend much less on their defence and to avoid the ugly temptations of nuclear defence systems. But nothing lasts forever. Hugh White says that this long era of stability is finished. Over the past decades, America has been engaged in a classic power struggle in the region with China, and Hugh thinks the most likely outcome is now clear. America will lose, and China will win. So what will that mean for Australia? Well, our prime ministers have been saying for years that Australia doesn't have to choose between the great power that makes us rich and the one that's been keeping us safe. But the US has been effectively receding from this region for years, and we might have to get used to a world where the rules are set by China. Hugh White is Professor of Strategic Studies at the ANU, and he was the principal author of Australia's Defence White Paper in 2000. And he's written an explosive quarterly essay that's titled Without America, Australia in the New Asia. Hello, Hugh.
Good to be with you.
Thanks for exploding a lot of my comfortable assumptions that I've been operating under for a while. Yes, thank you so much for that. Let's go back to the world as it was, if you like, the post-war world. The stability of that world in East Asia was underwritten by the United States, and it's lasted for the last 70 years or so. How has that lasted so long?
Well, I think there were two things that drove America at the end of the Second World War. It had defeated Japan. It had emerged as the dominant power in Asia, of course, having done that. And it was held into Asia. It preserved that strong commitment to maintaining its own dominant role in Asia because it wanted to confront the Soviet Union and originally China as communist powers in the great Cold War ideological contest which came after the Second World War. And then after 1972, when China had separated from the Soviet Union, the Chinese and the United, when Nixon went to China, that the Chinese and the United States agreed not to compete. China essentially agreed under Mao to accept America as the dominant power in Asia. America emerged as the uncontested primary power in Asia. And so it became very cheap for America to sustain a strong position in Asia. And so ever since the Second World War, and particularly ever since 1972, we have been able to take it for granted that America would be the region's dominant power. And because it's our close ally and we have all those links that our politicians keep talking about, legitimately enough, links of history and culture and language and tradition and values and all that sort of stuff, we've been unusually able to rely on America to keep us safe, to keep Asia stable, and to make sure that Asia works well for us. Our great and powerful friends have not just helped us, defended us, but they've made Asia a place where it's easy for us to do business. And that's really what I think is now coming to an end.
In the 1990s, as I recall, China was starting to make some threatening noises around Taiwan. So President Clinton then parked a couple of aircraft carriers off the coast. And that seemed to settle things down. That worked back then, didn't it?
Yes. One of the reasons why America was able to sustain this uncontested primacy, one of the reasons why China was willing to accept America's dominant position, was that back then America's economy was still much bigger than China's. Its military power was incomparably bigger than China's. The Chinese had not yet really begun to develop the kind of air and naval capabilities that it would need to confront the United States in the Western Pacific. And China's own economic growth depended fundamentally on continuing to work with America. Since then, almost all of that has changed. China's economy has already overtaken America's economy on one measure, and probably will on any measure within a few years. And it's likely to keep on growing after that. China is going to end up with a substantially bigger economy than America's, and that makes a huge difference to the balance of power. China has developed its military capabilities to the point where, of course, they're not yet equal to America's viewed globally, but in the Western Pacific, where it counts for this contest, China's now got a lot more capacity to do really critical things, including sinking aircraft carriers.
Closer to home, too.
Closer to home, of course. Yeah. They have this huge advantage because they're operating in their own backyard. And so if there was a Taiwan crisis tomorrow, which there could be, America would not deploy their aircraft carriers the way they did back in 1996. The chances of them being sunk is just too high.
China's dramatic growth, as you say, has upended all these assumptions. Now, this is the first comfortable assumption I'd had that your quarterly essay exploded, Hugh. And that was this, that China wouldn't try to compete with America strategically in the region, because why would it want to waste all that money on defence systems, knowing that America has no design to invade the Chinese mainland, when they could just spend all that money on consumerism instead and get all the economic clout that they wanted? What was wrong with that assumption? Because that's not how it's panned out, is it?
Yeah, no, look, that's right. It was perfectly valid assumption, as far as it went. That is, you can mount a very sensible argument that China has benefited enormously from America's dominant position in Asia. America has kept the region safe and working well, not just for countries like Australia, but for China. It's provided the essential framework of security and stability and open markets and all of that, which have been essential to China's phenomenal economic growth. And so the argument that, you know, Chinese would have no reason to overturn it looks very logical if you're sitting in Washington. Or for that matter, in Canberra. But view it from Beijing, and there are two really critical things. The first is, from the Chinese point of view, they believe, I think perhaps legitimately, that the Americans have been willing to support and foster China's growth and development as long as the Americans didn't feel it threatened them. But the Chinese always feared that the Americans would start to fear that China's growing power would threaten them and therefore would start to try to choke it off. But that's kind of a practical reason, but a deeper, more emotional reason is that from the Chinese point of view, they are, like most other states, and particularly like great powers, very conscious of their own status. And no country, perhaps more so than China, thousands of years of history, a long consciousness of its historical role as a leading power in Asia, a very intense sense of humiliation at the hands of Western powers, particularly the Western powers like Britain and America, the Anglo-Saxons, from the middle of the 19th century right through till the middle of the 20th century. And then a huge consciousness of what they've achieved in the decades since then. I think, you know, we don't want to forget how proud the Chinese must be about what they've achieved, dragging their country out of terrible poverty to today's level of prosperity.
So we're in the realm of emotion here, then.
It is a lot of emotion, and of course, as there always is. I mean, one of the reasons that makes international affairs a bit of a dicey business is the remarkable way, the extent to which states behave just like people do. And people want to be rich and they want to be safe, but they also want to feel good about themselves.
They want status above
they
all,
want
actually.
Status above all. And, you know, the whole history of humankind and the whole history of international relations is people putting their desire for status ahead of their desire to be safe and rich. And so countries will take risks all the time.
That's something the bean counters don't get, do they? No.
That's right. Yeah. And so I think China is behaving exactly as we'd expect rising powers to behave throughout history, what the British did when their economy grew, what the Americans did when their economy grew, what the Spanish in the 16th century did when their economy grew. Rising powers want to spread more space and build a sphere of influence for themselves, and the Chinese are just doing that. And I think Americans underestimated how powerful that was going to be. And not just for the guys, not just for the leaders. I think if you go into the streets in Shanghai or Changsha or, streets of China, say, do you think China should be subordinate to the United States, or should it stand up proud as a great power in its own right? You'll get a very clear answer.
Fast forward now to the year 2011, and there's this thing that happens in Parliament House in Canberra that maybe a lot of people missed at the time. The significance was missed at the time. President Obama visits Australia, and he addresses the National Parliament in Canberra, and this is part of his speech.
As President, I have therefore made a deliberate and strategic decision. As a Pacific nation, the United States will play a larger and long-term role in shaping this region and its future. By upholding core principles and in close partnership with our allies and friends. So here is what this region must know. We will allocate the resources necessary to maintain our strong military presence in this region. The United States is a Pacific power, and we are here to stay.
That's President Obama speaking in Canberra in Parliament House to our assembled parliamentarians, including Prime Minister Gillard at the time. Now, when that happened, I think I heard that as business as usual. What was really going on there? What's the driving force behind President Obama's pivot to Asia speech, Hugh?
What drove it was a recognition in Washington over the few years before that the comfortable assumption that China was going to accept American primacy forever wasn't proving correct, that the Chinese had started to push the envelope. For a long time, the Chinese had this slogan, bide your time, and we should bide our time and hide our power. And it became apparent In around about 2007 and 2008, around the time of the global financial crisis, though that wasn't the only factor involved, that China was no longer biding its time. The time had come. Its economy had grown enormously. It now had the power to try and assert itself as a great power in Asia and contest America's position, the position that Obama was committing America to uphold. And so what Obama felt he needed to do was to reassure America's allies and warn China as an American rival that America wasn't going to go lightly. It was determined to retain its or even expand its primary position in Asia. And so this was an attempt to push back against what they already saw as China's developing challenge to US leadership in the region. And the fact that he chose to come and deliver the speech in Canberra was not, to my mind, a coincidence. People in Washington knew that Australia had been developing a huge economic relationship with China. They watched with surprise and interest and a touch of dismay the way John Howard, you know, the closest, you know, strongest supporter of the US alliance you could imagine in Australia, had nonetheless cozied up to China to develop this massive economic relationship, had invited the then president, Hu Jintao, to address our parliament just the day after George W. Bush had done, day before George W. Bush had done. So they were worried that Australia, that they were losing Australia. And so I think Obama chose to come to Canberra to deliver that big speech, which wasn't just directed at Australian audiences, but throughout the region.
To the Philippines, to Japan, to South Korea, to Thailand.
To the Chinese.
And to the Chinese.
But what he wanted to do was to make the point that by doing this in Australia, he wanted to put his arm around Australia and say, "You're with us, aren't you?"
It was old pal.
Mate. It was a pretty unsubtle piece of diplomatic symbolism.
Well, here's the thing, though. Did he mean it? Did he mean it when he said the US was pivoting to Asia and was going to devote substantial resources to maintaining America's strategic presence in East Asia?
No, in the end he didn't. And the problem he had, and the problem I think America in general has had, is that although they could start to see in at that time, back in 2011, that China was challenging, they still underestimated the seriousness of that challenge. They took the view that all the United States had to do was to just hold up a stop sign. Please stop. We are the dominant power in Asia and we intend to remain so don't take us on. They thought that if America just said that, the Chinese would suddenly shrink back and say, "Oh, sorry, didn't mean to offend. You know, we'll go back to the place you want us to occupy, a subordinate place." And I think that massively underestimated the seriousness of China's challenge, how important this is to them, how deep their motivation is. And in the end, Obama was only prepared to put symbolic resources in, deploy a few Marines to Darwin, base a couple of little ships in Singapore, make declarations about future naval deployments without any real substance to them. But the United States did nothing under the pivot which was anything like the scale of redirection of US strategic effort that would have been required to meet a challenge from a country as powerful as China in its own backyard.
And needless to say, this was noticed, the fact that Obama did not back up his words with action then.
That's right. It was noted, and has ever since, I think, been noted in China and elsewhere in Asia, that this declaration of resolve ended up having nothing behind it. And when that happens, of course, it ends up not being a demonstration of resolve, but a demonstration of weakness.
How soon did Beijing test America's resolve to commit, I'm quote Obama again here, every element of American power to preserve its position in Asia?
They didn't let the grass grow under their feet. So Obama delivers that speech in November 2011. In March 2012, the Chinese took advantage, I would say, of an opportunity to push the Philippines, Filipino fishermen in particular, out of a reef in the South China Sea, Scarborough Shoals, which had been contested between China and the Philippines for a long time. But the Philippines had occupied it. The Chinese, in a very assertive move, used their coast guard to push the Filipino fishermen out of it and really assert their own control over it. And considering that Philippines is a US ally, this was a very direct confrontation of the United States. So the Philippines objected to what had happened. The Americans stepped in and tried to negotiate some sort of deal, which the Chinese ignored. The Philippines quietly turned over their shoulder and asked the United States whether the United States was willing to lend them the 7th Fleet for the weekend so that the US Navy might go in and push the Chinese out. And the Americans said no. Now, they said no because they didn't think it was a good idea to risk a military clash with China over something as insignificant as Scarborough Shoals, uninhabitable rock in the middle of the South China Sea. But of course, by doing that, what they showed was that they didn't have the resolve They weren't prepared to use all the elements of American power to prevent China doing that kind of thing. And in the game of power politics, which is what we're talking about here, that kind of symbolism becomes very important. Power politics is the way in which countries struggle, great powers in particular, struggle with one another when they're competing over their place in the international system. And when that happens, the willingness to use armed force becomes very symbolically significant. If I'm willing to use armed force and you're not, then even if we don't fight, I'm going to end up asserting my leadership and you're going to end up stepping back. And that's really what the situation the Chinese are trying to engineer. And I think for them, Obama's very stern statement in Canberra, the big pivot speech, unbacked up by any substantial deployment of resources or willingness to use those resources and risk a conflict, provided a perfect opportunity for the Chinese to show the world that they are now stronger than the United States. They have more resolve. They are willing to take risks that the United States is not willing to do. That's how leadership passes from one country to another.
To use a really sort of crappy analogy, is it a bit like there's some guy out in the street with a gun giving cool but stern orders, ordering people about, and the people who are being ordered about go, well, we've got a mate two blocks away who's in his house. We'll just ring him up and get him down with his gun. And the guy two blocks away is thinking, oh, I might get shot.
Exactly, and I'm worried about what's happening in my own backyard anyway. I think those homely analogies actually work quite well, because in the end, great states do behave quite a lot like people. And the question the United States asked itself, the question Obama would have asked himself when he wondered whether to send the carriers in to push the Chinese out of Scarborough Shoals back in 2012, is there is a risk that this could escalate into a conflict. There is a risk that conflict could get out of hand. Is it worth my while? Is it worth America's while running that risk with a country as important and powerful as China over this issue?
But let's be clear about this. America's military is 2.5 times the size of China's. That's a lot less big than it used to be in the past. But nonetheless, it's still 2.5 times the size of China's. In any fight, if America was prepared to fight, it would win, wouldn't it?
No, not necessarily. The thing about military operations is that it doesn't matter just what you've got, but also what you can do with it where it counts. And China has a lot of asymmetrical advantages. You're right, of course. China's military is way weaker than the United States in aggregate.
It doesn't have the technology the United States has either.
No, but it does have a lot of things going for it. One is that it's not trying to be a world policeman. It's only competing with the United States in its own backyard, whereas the United States is trying to do things in the Middle East and Eastern Europe and all the rest of it. The second is that China is operating close to its own bases, which gives it a huge advantage just in terms of how much effort it has to go into achieve a result. But the really big thing is that America, because it's not in the region, has to project power by sea into the region. And China just has to stop the United States projecting power by sea. And to be really blunt about that, that means the United States has got to send a whole lot of stuff in big ships, and all the Chinese have to do is to find and sink those ships. And that is what the Chinese have focused billions of dollars in defense investment over the last 20 years in doing. And so the Chinese are now in a position not to defeat the United States in some sort of grand, sort of World War II way, but to raise the cost and risk to the United States of deploying forces into the Western Pacific by being able to do things like sinking American carriers, to the point where an American president would find it very hard to say, yeah, that's a good idea, let's do that.
You say that China's been doing this through this process of kind of strategic salami slicing. If the salami, I suppose, is US power, I don't know, they're slicing off bits at a time, thin slices at a time, though. Very thin slices, maybe increasingly bigger slices at a time. So no one incident is worth going to war for.
That's exactly it. I mean, it's what the point about salami slicing is that people talked about it during the Cold War, the Soviet Union might try and take West Berlin. West Berlin wasn't, in the end, worth a war. But because it was a slice of the salami, if you couldn't stop them slicing that bit of salami, then which slice would you stop them taking before you knew it? They'd have the whole sausage. And so the Chinese have run that playbook in a copybook fashion. They have deliberately selected things. That's one of the reasons why they're focusing on the South China Sea, that are insignificant in themselves. So it was very hard for the Americans to persuade themselves that a war with China over the Scarborough Shoals was a good idea. But by failing to respond, the United States demonstrated its weakness. China, by forcing the United States to acquiesce in what China was doing, demonstrated its strength. Therefore, allies start to become less confident in the United States. The Chinese become more confident in their assertion. Everyone starts to recognize that China can challenge the United States at sea, where the US used to be unchallengeable. And so the the status, prestige, the leadership credentials start to shift from Washington to Beijing.
This is when we start to get into the Dr. Strangelove bunker here, isn't it?
It
to
is
some
a
degree.
Bit.
So thinking even another step further beyond the US projecting its power via sea through aircraft carriers, if that aircraft carrier is sunk, what's the next level? China has an arsenal of nuclear weapons. So does the United States. China has a vastly smaller arsenal of nuclear weapons, but they are attached to ICBMs, isn't that? Aren't they?
Yeah.
Are they
yeah.
So they can, they could, in theory, send one into the air and have it land in a US city. Is this really the final consideration any president, like President Obama or President Trump, has to take into consideration?
Yes, it is. It seems in some ways absurd that a confrontation over an uninhabited reef in the South China Sea might lead to a nuclear exchange. But what
it's hard to believe the assassination of an archduke in Sarajevo could use to a continental and a global conflict either.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And what happens is that unless you can be absolutely sure that there's a point above which the conflict won't escalate, then if you're a nuclear power and if you're in a conflict with a nuclear power, you simply can't begin even the smallest confrontation without asking, if this escalates, where does it end? And in the case of a conflict in the South China Sea, because of that shift in military balance that I talked about before, neither China nor the United States could win a decisive difference in a little local squabble around a particular feature. So it very likely would escalate. So the two sides started attacking one another's bases. America would attack bases on mainland China. The Chinese would attack US bases in places like Japan and Guam. And once that begins, then both sides start asking themselves, at what point do they start using nuclear weapons? And the possibility of escalation across that threshold becomes very real. Not highly likely, but you only need a very low probability for it to be a very big weight on everybody's decision.
And what's the cost of a massive backdown when a leader decides he or she isn't prepared to go to those extents?
That's what makes these situations so dangerous. If you allow a situation to develop where the Chinese and the United States are facing off militarily over some insignificant rock and reef, then the further down the track of escalation they go, the more they rattle their sabres and say, we're not going to allow you to do this, or we're not going to be stopped from doing this, the bigger the cost of their own prestige and leadership credentials if they do back down. And so if you're going to back the rule of crisis management, if you're going to back off early, because the later you leave it to back off once the crisis has begun, the worse it looks. And the real danger you run in these situations is that both sides head into a confrontation expecting the other side to back off. So I think you're going to back off, you think I'm going to back off, so I don't back off, even though I don't want a war. Neither of us want a war. But if we both think the other guy is going to back off, we think we can get what we want without a war. That also is what happened in 1914.
So given that so much is at stake here, it seems to me what you're saying is the upshot of this is, as China's been practicing this salami slicing, sort of pushing forward, taking over this shoal, taking over this reef, exercising more control on the South China Sea, America's response is just to cop it and pretend it doesn't matter.
Well, it's almost worse than that, because what they've done is they've complained about it. They've said, we're not going to accept this.
Drawn a line.
And they've drawn a line, and then they haven't been prepared to do what would be required to enforce it. So the Americans have said that the Chinese are, you know, it's unacceptable. They've used that word, unacceptable, for the Chinese to be building these bases on contested islands in the South China Sea.
And that matters when you say things like unacceptable.
It does if you then end up accepting it.
Yeah. And so the upshot of this is then that America's allies in the region have noted this.
That's
Japan,
right.
South Korea, Philippines, Australia have seen all this and said America doesn't mean what it says.
That's right. And so when the United States says we are going to remain the dominant power in Asia, as Obama said in that speech, and encourages the United States encourages countries like Australia and Japan to continue to depend on American power to defend them from Chinese pressure, and then they see that the United States is reluctant to come forward and resist Chinese pressure on its allies, they start asking themselves, can we trust these guys? And conversely, when they see the Chinese start to flex their muscles, they start to take what China does more seriously, because they're much less sure that the United States is going to be there to help them, and they're much less sure that the Chinese don't mean what they say.
So this is why you say this conversation about whether America will stay a major power, the predominant power in the region, is finished. Now, America is walking away from the region. It is, because it keeps putting this language out. It doesn't back it up. It makes statements that it won't support in the end with hard action and military spending and military presence.
Yeah, look, that's exactly right. And I think that what what the reason I think this is such a deep and sort of substantial trend is that I don't judge that just on the basis of how the Obama administration, for example, actually responded to what China did, but by looking at the deeper question of, well, is it really worth America's while to confront China in Asia? Are America's interests in Asia big enough to justify the costs and risks of confronting and competing strategically with a country as powerful and determined as China is today? So I think the decisions we have seen, the decision not to contest China's position in the South China Sea effectively, has reflected a really deep shift in the actual distribution of power and interest between the two countries.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio. On air, online, and on your mobile.
So this brings us to 2016 and the election campaign, and Donald Trump is the Republican nominee, and he starts saying all kinds of interesting things, amongst many interesting things, as part of his platform, where he pretty much makes the case that America's allies are hangers-on. They're parasites that are living on the cheap, not spending enough money on defence, letting Americans' taxpayers spend money on their own defence. How much of a shock did that constitute to the international system?
This is a very big shock indeed, because, you know, one of the sort of iron verities of international affairs since the end of the Cold War has been that America inherited, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, this position of global leadership. Everyone assumed that the American public was absolutely committed to it. Almost everyone in American politics, from one of the few things that America's very divided politics agreed on, from the Democrats across to the Republicans, was that America had this global leadership role and it was imperative that it sustain it. And in order to do that, it had to support its allies and build huge defense budgets and all this sort of stuff. And then Trump just comes in and trashes it and says, no, we're not interested in this. The North Koreans and the South Koreans and the Japanese can look after themselves. NATO's irrelevant. And, of course, it's tied up with his economic nationalism, but there's a very distinct strategic and political point here as well. He doesn't think America should be spending its blood and treasure going out defending other countries from regional threats. He's willing, and he boasts about being prepared to defend America from things that threaten America directly, but that's very different from taking on a role as a global policeman. And everyone in the American foreign policy and political establishment says you can't possibly win an election by trashing what everyone believed was the universally accepted view of America's role in the world, and then he won it. So what that told us is that everyone in Washington who believed that this was something every American agreed on turned out to be wrong, and it transpires that the American public is much less committed to the vision of America as the global policeman than everyone assumed they were.
Well, how about all that expenditure of blood and treasure in Iraq? Do you think that's hugely reduced the United States' appetite for becoming involved in foreign wars?
Absolutely. I think it's been extremely significant. And the reason for that is that the American public were told in the late 90s, after the victory in the Cold War, that it could be the global hegemon, it could be the leader of the global order on the cheap, because no country was ever going to dare to compete with the United States. Its power was unchallengeable. Its military was unchallengeable. So if it had to fight wars, they'd be short and quick and cheap. The other guy would take all the casualties, like the war with Iraq over Kuwait all the way back in 1990-91, where the United States won this effortless and decisive victory. And everyone thought that's what it was going to be like. The second Iraq war told a different story, that although the United States has massive armed force, there are a lot of things it can't do. A lot of things it can't do in the Middle East, but also a lot of things it can't do in Eastern Europe and Asia. And so the Americans have discovered how much it's going to cost them to sustain that position of leadership in the face of the actual challenges they face in those key areas. And the American public out there in voter land just decided they weren't prepared to pay that cost. And we saw that in the way in which Trump was able to mobilize a really remarkable degree of support for his unexpected foreign policies. But we also saw it on the other side of politics with Bernie Sanders. On the Democrat side, here's Bernie Sanders, a bloke who describes himself as a socialist, which in American political terms is almost unimaginable, who runs Hillary Clinton, a very close second for the Democrat nomination, proposing a foreign policy which, although his tone was very different from Trump's, the content was remarkably similar. He too was opposed to America performing a role of a world policeman. So I think we've seen a permanent shift in American attitudes to their global role.
Even if you take Iraq out of the equation, America's very self-absorbed right now. There's a kind of a cold civil war going on with the United States, from red states and blue states, where some really deep hatreds in the United States directed against each other within America. There doesn't seem like there's that kind of national resolve to pull together and take an interest in the world around them at the moment.
Look, I think that's right. And I think the division is not just between the, you know, Democrats and Republicans, red and blue. I think it's also between the political establishment of whatever colour and the rest of the country. You know, people in Washington are very keen on talking about, both Democrats and Republicans, about America's capacity to shape the world to suit American interests and values. But out there where the soldiers and sailors and air crew are actually recruited from, where the real consequences of these conflicts come home to roost, that enthusiasm is just not shared. So I think you're absolutely right. We don't see in the United States today a country with the resolve to undertake the kind of role that its political leaders have tended to assume for it.
This seems critical to me. It's hard to sustain national resolve when your people are just not into it.
Yeah.
How about the Chinese people? Are they into it?
I think the Chinese people really are into it. Of course, they are pretty confident. They're very confident in their power. And I think they're very confident that they've got the United States on the run. Nobody in Beijing, nobody in China, well, I shouldn't say nobody, very few people in China will be dumb enough to want to have a war with the United States. The United States remains a very formidable power. But people in China, I think, are very confident that the United States is, in the end, going to do what I think the United States is doing, and that is stepping back quietly from Asia because they discover they're not prepared to pay the costs and risks of confronting China. So the Chinese think they're on a winning streak, and so they believe they can assert national leadership, regional leadership in East Asia without confronting the United States militarily. And so there now, the confidence now lies with China rather than with the United States.
Does China have some reason to say to the United States, by what right are you the predominant power in East Asia?
Look, it does, and there are elements of the way in which Chinese academics and scholars and so on, opinion formers, they certainly say that kind of thing. The Chinese government tends not to, but that's because the Chinese government is trying to ease the United States out of Asia gently. Well, you might say not so gently, considering what they're doing in the South China Sea. But the Beijing has a big focus on not trying to overtly humiliate the United States, and particularly under Trump. They see in Trump a great opportunity. They see a leader who's not really committed, not at all committed, to sustaining America's strategic position in Asia, but also a leader who's very sensitive to being humiliated. So the art is to keep pushing, but just push slowly, so there's no point at which Trump turns around and feels that he's been got at.
Right, you strike his vanity.
Exactly.
You strike his vanity, show up at Mar-a-Lago, play golf with a guy.
Exactly, and this is what they did when he was in Beijing on a big state visit last month, when they turned on everything, rolled out all the red carpets, and
Trump goes, that's more like it.
Exactly, he purred with pride.
So you can't go to London at the moment because there'll be demonstrations.
No, that's right. Exactly.
Their oldest ally.
I think Trump is a pretty easy guy to play, and the Chinese are playing him very well.
God. Well, this brings us to Australia now, and this is really the key factor here. Watching that footage of President Obama, going back to 2011 in Canberra when he announces the pivot to Asia in Parliament, you can see some shots of Prime Minister Julia Gillard, and she's smiling.
Yeah.
I don't want to read too much into this, but she looks uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Was she uncomfortable with that speech of Obama's?
Look, I think she was. She certainly should have been, because in the end, it did pose a very serious challenge to Australia. You see, Australia built this fantastic trading relationship with China, which, you know, has underpinned our economic growth over a couple of very difficult decades, on the basis of a simple understanding that John Howard reached with Beijing back in 1996 in his first year as Prime Minister. He went to Beijing and said, look, we want a really strong relationship with you. We know you don't like us being a US ally. We are going to remain a US ally. There's nothing you can do about that. But here's the deal. Nothing we do as a US ally will be directed against China. And the Chinese say, that's fine. We don't mind you saying US ally as long as it's not directed at us. And the good news for Howard was that for the rest of his time as Prime Minister, That was an easy promise to keep because America wasn't focused on China. America wasn't really seeing China as a challenger. It was focused on the Middle East, where Australia was providing lots of eager help. And so that worked very well. But as soon as Obama stands up in our parliament and says very clearly that America is going to contest China's challenge to US leadership in Asia and expect allies like Australia to support them, then all of a sudden it becomes very difficult for Australia to continue to maintain the relationship we need with China.
Mummy and Daddy are fighting.
Exactly. And as is sometimes the way in politics, the fact that we started to have to make choices between how we managed our relationship with China and managed our relationship with the United States zoomed into focus. And the way the politicians on both sides of politics responded was by saying precisely the opposite. We don't have to choose between America and China, as you mentioned before. That became the mantra. And that was obviously wrong. We were obviously making choices all the time between them.
What does America think about that mantra, we don't have to choose?
They don't like it. I mentioned in the essay, not long before they left office, I was having a conversation with a senior Obama administration official who said to me, I hate it when you guys say you don't have to choose between America and China. You do have to choose, damn it. You should be choosing us. And that's really the point. America looks to Australia to unambiguously support America as it pushes back against China's growing power and ambition, and it hasn't had it. And the reason it hasn't had it is that everyone in Canberra knows that if Australia really did that, then the Chinese would start to really put the pressure on us, economic pressure on us, and no one's prepared to risk that.
Let's play a little game here, a what if scenario. I think, as you people like you do this all the time, say China takes a much more assertive role over Taiwan, threatens it. Yeah. Now Taiwan's special and, I would argue, precious, because for a long while Asian autocratic leaders are saying, oh, democracy can't take root in here amongst the Confucian culture, et cetera, et cetera. But it has taken root in Taiwan, like it has in South Korea, properly taken root. If democracy there was crushed and China exerted powerful sovereignty over it, what kind of choice would that bring upon Australia and the United States?
A really difficult, tragic choice, actually. I agree. I think what's happened in Taiwan over the last couple of decades, the establishment of a very vibrant, very deeply rooted democratic political culture, is terrifically heartening and terrifically important.
It aligns with our values.
Absolutely aligns with our values and with America's. And what's more, of all of the issues that America has in Asia, the status of Taiwan, not as an independent state, because the United States doesn't assert that, but as a country that can, or as an entity that can retain its distance from China, the status quo as it's existed for so long, that's really central to America in Asia. And so if the Chinese did move to use force to reintegrate Taiwan with the mainland, it would be a huge issue for America and a huge issue for us. And one would think that that would be the issue, if there was ever an issue in Asia in which we should be willing and the Americans should be willing to go to war with China to stop them. But on the other side of the table, there's a simple fact that as China's military capability has grown, the military costs to America of trying to do that have grown to the point where the United States, I believe, no longer has serious military options. And that is, and if there was ever an issue in which China would be willing to go to a nuclear exchange, it would be Taiwan, because for the Chinese, that's a really gut issue as well.
It's deeply felt, isn't it?
Very deeply felt.
I think a lot of Australians would be looking to form stronger alliances with Japan and perhaps India as these very powerful countries, maybe ASEAN as well, as these blocks that may hem in or contain Chinese power in the region. That's a pretty reasonable assumption to make, isn't it?
It's a natural hope. I don't think it's one with much chance of success. You can see, for example, in the government's new foreign policy white paper just published last week before, that this is a natural idea, that as China's power grows, as we become less confident in the United States, the natural thing for us to do is to try and work with the other democracies in Asia, and particularly India and China as the biggest and most powerful. But I think it's going to be very hard to really make that work. I think the main reason for that is that all of these countries have enormous interests themselves in their relations with China. The question we've got to ask ourselves is a country like India or Japan willing, in a crunch where we're under pressure from China, to sacrifice its relationships with China to support us? Or will they say, no, in the end, that's Australia's problem? Now, it's easy, you know, in times of peace and tranquility to sort of have meetings between countries like they had last month where they talk about cooperating. But when the chips are down, I think it's going to be very difficult for those countries to really sacrifice their interest in their relationship with China for us, and vice versa. Would we cut off our economic relationship with China to support India over some dispute in the Himalayas, or support Japan over some dispute in the East China Sea? I don't think so. In the end, the alignment of interests is not strong enough to turn that group of countries into an effective bloc.
I'm with Hugh White. He's the author of Quarterly Essay, Without America, Australia in the New Asia. Not long after Trump was inaugurated, there was that famous phone call with Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull, which turned abusive on Trump's part. I mean, I recall thinking after that happened that I didn't think anyone in the cabinet would be saying anything out loud, but in closed sessions or in amongst themselves, Australia's political leaders would be concluding all kinds of things about the reliability of the United States after a phone call in which the President of the United States treated our Prime Minister like a sponger. Yeah. Is that going on? What do you know about that?
Look, I do think it's going on. Obviously, our government has been extremely careful.
You hearing anything about this? I mean, you've been advisors to prime ministers in the past. Are you hearing things?
Well, I'm not an advisor anymore, but you can't work around Canberra without being conscious of the fact there's a huge amount of anxiety about the style and manner of Trump as an individual and of the Trump administration. There is a debate. Some people think, look, Trump's flaky, but he's got good people around him. People like General Mattis, and at least so far, Rex Tillerson as state, if he lasts in that job.
Oh, his fingernails, yeah.
Yeah, if he lasts in that job for long. But I think the consensus has grown over the last, 12 months it nearly is now, that notwithstanding the existence of some broadly competent people elsewhere in the administration, that the Trump operation is incapable of delivering consistent, coherent foreign policy. And apart from anything else, that's because Trump himself is still the president. The president has enormous power, and he is totally undisciplined in what he says and does. And so this is, of course, enormously worrying. The problem for us, that Australian political leaders see is, well, what can you do about that except hang on to your hat and hope it passes? But I think myself that's a mistake, partly because I don't think he's going to pass. I mean, of course, Trump might leave office in all sorts of ways, but the chances of him seeing out his present term, and for that matter, the chance of him getting a second term, which means he could be in office until 2024, are quite high. And even if he doesn't, Trump is, you know, a weird anomaly, of course. But the fact that he was elected reflects quite deep fundamental trends in the way American political life is going. And although I think we'd be very unlucky to get another Trump again, the idea that we're going to end up with political leaders like, you know, Clinton and the earlier
Mitt
Bushes.
Mitt Romney,
you know, sort of what you might call normal functional American political leaders. I think the chances of that happening are pretty low. You know, on the Democrat side, we could end up with someone like Elizabeth Warren, for example, who would be, you know, a much more responsible president, but she would be very unlikely to take the kind of romanticized view of America's alliances around the world that traditionally we have taken for granted.
So your argument then is the shrewd thing, unpalatable as it may seem to many leaders, would be to assume that America's receding presence will continue to recede.
Yes.
And in 10, 20 years from now, we'll be living in a region where China is increasingly setting the rules. It's setting up the grand economic institutions that previously have been led by the United States, and its strategic sway over the South China Sea is not questioned. How about the insidious effect that China's seems to be taking to our domestic politics? I mean, you've come in today at a very interesting time.
Yeah.
When Sam Dastyari has been asked to stand down again for making comments about China's activities in the South China Sea that's contrary to ALP policy. And the government has now declared a ban on foreign donations.
Yeah.
What's your view on that, Hugh?
Well, look, what we're seeing here is the painful process of Australia adapting to a very different world ever since, you know, first European settlement in 1780. We've always been able to assume that either Britain or America would set the rules in Asia, set the framework within which other countries would relate to us.
In language that we can understand.
Exactly. Yeah. Thankfully, they do it in English. But it's really important. We take it for granted, as if there's always going to be a dominant Anglo-Saxon maritime power looming over Asia, making Asia safe for us. And in, at times, you know, with Japanese power grew, or when Mao's China was threatening in the 1960s, we're worried about that. But we've always in the end believed that that would keep on happening. And the reason we've had faith in that is because in the end, Britain and then America were successively the world's biggest economies by miles. Now the world's biggest economy is China. So there's fundamental shift in the distribution of wealth and power. And we are going to have to, and particularly if I'm right, as I think I am, about what that means for America's position in Asia, we are going to live in a region in which China is the preponderant power. That is going to give it lots of capacity, not just military capacity, but economic pressure, political pressure, diplomatic pressure, to shape Australia's position on things. And what I think we can see in the sort of upswing of concern about Chinese influence here over the last few months and just the last few days is our sudden realization that America is not necessarily going to be there to set the rules of the game. We're facing a very powerful country like China, essentially alone, and we're going to have to start paying much more careful attention to how we manage China's influence and how we respond to it.
Now you argue in this quarterly essay that if we are to uphold our values as a country, as a democratic values, freedom of speech, rule of law, all those things, within Australia, domestically, if we're going to do that, we will have to maximise our influence at minimal cost to ourselves.
Yes.
That's the shrewd way of looking at things. That's just how it has to be seen. How might Australia do that?
Well, the first thing we have to do is to recognise the nature of the problem. See, I think the problem we've had so far is that our political leadership on both sides of the aisle has been very reluctant to acknowledge the way in which America's power and influence in Asia has been fading.
Does that reflect their genuine thinking, or are they just not being frank with us as the Australian people? Are they having these private conversations I'm talking about? I mean, they're not stupid, our political leaders. They know what's going on. Or are they stuck in a mindset, or are they just not sharing their secret, real thoughts with us?
No, the bad news is, well, they're not stupid, but they are scared. I think you can say the Australia's political class is in denial about this. Partly it's because they've all been brought up to believe that American power is unchallengeable, and they've found it extremely difficult, even today, to recognise how serious the challenge is that actually looms is. And you can see this in the white paper. You can see it in the way Labor speaks as well, the foreign policy white paper, and you can see it in the way Labor speaks as well. There's a determination to believe that somehow the United States will continue to play the primary role in Asia, come what may. And so I think, you know, I think it is a kind of psychological denial. It's a refusal to see the facts that are staring you in the face because the consequences are so unsettling. Because this does require Australia to think its foreign policy from the ground up and in a way we've never done before. Now, I don't think it's something we can't do. You know, I think it's important to recognise how serious the challenge is. I also think it's important not to panic. Lots of countries in history have managed their relations with great powers and preserved their essential interests and their political system intact without the support of a great and powerful friend looming behind them. It's just hard work.
You remember when it was 1942? You know, Fortress Singapore, it's all right, we can send our troops over to Europe and North Africa and that'll be fine. And suddenly there's Japan right there suddenly, and it's like, oh my God, this lack refusal to accept the change circumstances led to initially a bit of a panic in Australia and the intercession of the United States eventually in this situation. Is this hopefully we're not going to approach that kind of a moment here.
Well, we hope we won't, but there's something of that psychology going on. But the bad news about 1941, 1942 is the British failed us. The good news was that America appeared out of nowhere. The problem we face today is that if America fails us today, as I believe it is, there's no one else. There's no next Anglo-Saxon, English-speaking, great and powerful friend to come to our assistance. New Zealand's not going to do it for us, and neither's Canada.
For years now, Australia's been practicing a kind of cultural outreach to China. You know, Mandarin is now taught in classes. We have a great many more Australian citizens who are of Chinese background, whether that's mainland China or Vietnamese China or Malaysian China or Singaporean China. So there are growing cultural affinities with China. Might there be aspects of this new world order that mightn't be so bad, that we might enjoy?
I think there can be and there should be, but I think the indications are a bit ambiguous. The good news is we have a million Australians of Chinese origin, and that is a massive asset for us, and we must never forget that. The bad news is that notwithstanding that fact, I think Australia's enthusiasm for engagement in Asia has waned over the last couple of decades. I think it's hard now to recall just how positive we were in the 80s and 90s, particularly, I'm going to allow myself to say, under Hawke and Keating. The idea of Asian, our Asian future, enmeshment with Asia, as Hawke called it, was something that they regarded as exciting.
And it was noted in the region too, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely, yeah, yeah. Absolutely. And I think it is true that in the last 20 years or so, we haven't preserved that sense of excitement. It's partly because we have been so willing to assume that America would always be there for us. So I think there's more dependence on the United States and less willingness to embrace the reality of an Asian future for Australia, and to embrace reality that one way or another that is going to change our identity. It's not to say we have to throw all our values out. It's not to say we have to become a satrapy of the Chinese Empire.
But we might evolve, though.
Yeah. But we will evolve. Mm. And you know, Australians, in a sense, have always understood that the idea of a European enclave on the outskirts of Asia was not something that could last forever. The trick for us is to manage that transition, to make sure we preserve the things that really matter to us. And we can only do that intelligently if we don't drift backwards into it, which is what we're doing at the moment.
Well, like I said, Hugh, your quarterly essay knocked over about 7 or 8 comfortable assumptions I've been holding. So thanks for that, I think. It's completely fascinating, and I really thank you for joining me today. Hugh White is Professor of Strategic Studies at ANU. He's the author of the quarterly essay, Without America, Australia in the New Asia. Our website is abc.net.au/conversations. I'm Richard Feidler.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.